Speech of Mr. Ringgold. On the evening of Thursday, March the 2nd, 1893, James T. Ringgold, Esquire of the Baltimore Bar, who has become so interested for our people and for the principles of religious liberty, that he volunteered to defend those who were arrested for Sunday labor, made a very interesting speech, which we are glad to be able to present herewith to the readers of the bulletin. Mr. Chairman, my friends of the International Religious Liberty Association, when I was called upon a day or two ago to address a few remarks to the Conference of the Seventh-day Adventists, I was taken rather by surprise. I may say that I was pleased to have a formal introduction to your people, but my real business out here was not to teach. The fact is, I came to listen and not to talk, and under these circumstances I felt, and I still feel, that I am doing myself an injury, and I am not by any means sure that I am doing you any good by consuming time that is so valuable both to you and me, and perhaps, at the present time, more valuable to me than to you. I am only studying the ABC of a vast body of truth wonderfully put, and many of you have graduated in it. When, therefore, I was waited upon yesterday by Brother Ballinger and invited in the kindliest and most polite manner which he had at his command, and none have a politer, and was given to understand that I was unfortunate the other day in not giving satisfaction, and that I would have to try again, why, I sat down to think, what on earth could be that I could add to what I already said to you? You know what I think of you. I will take the word of those few who have been kind enough to express their opinion of me as sufficient, lest I should fare worse in that regard. You know what is the great central idea which has brought me so far from home to meet people whom I admire so much. That idea is embodied in your Religious Liberty Association, or at any rate, the first elements of it. A very great philosopher in his opening address at our grandest of universities, John Hopkins, which, by the way, I have been reported undeservedly as being connected with, and I wish to add right here, for the benefit of any reporters that may be present, that I belong to the Baltimore University, a distinct institution, I say. A very great philosopher came over here some years ago. His name was Huxley. You have all heard of him. One thing Mr. Huxley said struck me very forcibly, both in what seemed to be the idea and the suggested thoughts, and because of the impression that I had heard it somewhere else before. Professor Huxley said, "It is undoubtedly true that man shall not live by bread alone, but by ideas." If I had not known all about Professor Huxley, I should have branded him then and there as a literary thief. I went home, and by the aid of a concordance found that a philosopher quite as great as Professor Huxley had already enunciated the same idea, though in slightly different words, which, of course, you have at your command. Now, if it be true, and it must be true, since Professor Huxley endorsed it, and you all know that he is an agnostic, it is nonetheless true that by ideas man shall perish. He shall rise and progress and develop by right ideas, and he shall perish by wrong ideas. Elder Jones talked to us last night about people who would say, "What is the use of making a fuss about the use of 24 hours in the calendar?" I tell you, as he told you, that behind that difference lies an idea. Well, it does not make any difference about the calendar. It does not make any difference about what 24 hours you take, provided you have got the right reason for taking it. It is the idea behind it that makes it good or evil. If I understand aright, the object of the International Religious Liberty Association is to battle for ideas and not for conduct. Not to have men compelled to do this or that, but to teach them that they should not do this and should not do that, and leave them to do what they please afterwards. That great truth of the all-importance of ideas is as deeply impressed on my mind as upon the mind of any member of the Religious Liberty Association, and it is that which has brought me here to commune with those of the same ideas with myself. I have heretofore been led to think of the matter indifferently. Of course, I see as plainly as anybody that to prohibit any man from doing this or that because of religious reasons was to fly in the very face of the idea propounded by that other great philosopher whose command to his followers was, "Put up again thy sword into its place, for all they that take the sword shall perish with the sword." Of course, I saw it with you that the Sabbath day was Saturday, and nobody could have been more plainly alive to the incongruity of the teaching and practice of my own communion that I, who had, Sunday after Sunday, listened to the ritual of my church, which stated that we were to remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy when we had all been breaking it the day before. All that had been clear enough to my mind for many, many years. I was, as I say, in the position of one who is indifferent on that subject. I laid no special stress on it except for myself, and had not considered the difference of ideas that was involved. I simply ordered my own conduct to please myself, did as I pleased, and as long as nobody interfered with me, I felt perfectly at ease. It was by accident, I really feel, when I consider the matter seriously, that it should be denominated by a stronger term, and by your permission, I will say, it was by special providence that I was called into contact with the Religious Liberty Association and your church. Now, men who are indifferent like myself never make any fight, or at least men who are like my former self, we are satisfied to be let alone. And we are the men who need to be waked up in the words of the hymn just sung. I assure you that I am at last thoroughly awake and appreciate fully the seriousness of the situation. Behind you lies not mere devotion to an idea for an idea's sake. You have appropriated that grand idea of Christianity, not merely because it is the truth, but because it is the truth, which was given to the world by the founder of Christianity, and which has been seized upon by the enemies of his religion and abandoned for these many centuries by his professed followers. This reappropriation of Christianity's fundamental idea to the religion to which it belongs seems to me to be the grandest achievement of the time. I remember once hearing a story about a clergyman who, being reproached for enjoying himself too much for a man of his calling, said that he did not see why the devil should be allowed a monopoly of all the good things in this world. So I have never been able to understand why that which is so great, so good, and human, and essentially American in principle as absolute religious equality, should be left for its defense altogether to infidels and to the enemies of that religion from which it originated. This is to me one of the greatest glories of Seventh-day Adventism, that it restores to the hands of the Christian Church those weapons for warfare with sin of soft, persuasion, sweet reasonableness, and absolute liberty of choice, which the Master placed in the hands of his followers, and which the early church recklessly cast away to substitute to their place the sword and spear of the past and the policeman's club of today. I have recently been down in the state of Tennessee, interesting myself there in the cases of some of your brethren. I have been requested to say a few words with reference to my experience there. I may say this, that I found there a hypocrisy which, if I may so put it, commanded my respect. Perhaps this statement involves a contradiction in terms. I suppose I do not commit myself to it as a proposition, but I suppose, at any rate, I can see that it is thinkable that when a man has made up his mind to do an indecent or blackguardly thing, there is a gleam of morality in the desire to do it in the dark. For instance, when he writes an insulting or threatening letter, perhaps, he is to be credited with the shame which prevents his signing his name to it, and when he wishes to involve his neighbor in trouble, perhaps he pays a tribute to honor and integrity when he skulls behind another to do it. That is a very profound moral question, which I will not attempt to discuss here. I found this principle existing in Tennessee, outside of Seventh-day Adventists, for there were those who wished the hand of the law to seize upon our people, but did not want to give testimony against them. So, when I had a conference with the prosecuting attorney, I urged him to nolo pros the cases on the ground of public policy, telling him that was what would be done in my state, or at least in my city of Baltimore, and that he could not afford to go to court with such a case. But I soon found that this spirit of persecution and this spirit of animosity is one of those things that grows by which it feeds on. To my disappointment, they would listen to no compromise, but insisted on going to trial with no evidence. But the state attorney had the grace and manliness to be ashamed of the proceedings and said that nothing would give him more pleasure than to act on my suggestion, but that he could not possibly do it because petitions were pouring in on him every day, signed by scores of citizens of the county, urging him to prosecute those Adventists, but for goodness sake, do not call us for witnesses. So the state's attorney tried the cases, and they all went off on legal technicalities but one, and upon that one we called no witnesses. We went to the jury on the state's testimony alone. An interesting as well as an amusing incident occurred in one of the cases. One of the witnesses for the state was a little boy, about 10 years old. The little fellow had evidently been impressed with the idea that he was to be charged with something or other, and that he might be ordered out to be hung at any moment, and so he took the position of the Irishman, who, when called before the judge and asked if he had pleaded guilty or not guilty, said it was impossible for him to tell which he was until he had heard the evidence. Well, the judge in this case asked the little fellow his name. He gave that all right. Then he asked him if he knew anything about swearing as a witness. No, sir, was the answer. Do you know what will become of a witness that does not swear to the truth? No, sir. Do you know what will become of a boy who didn't tell the truth? No, sir. Do you know anything about heaven or hell? No, sir. Ever been told anything about them? No, sir. You see, he was not going to commit himself until he had heard the evidence. The state attorney excused that witness. Toward the end of the case, he tried to call him back again, but after a little discussion, he dropped him at last. So our man was acquitted. We have heard good tidings from Tennessee since that time. We've been informed that no more indictments have been found and very little prospect for any more. For the present, at least, we have beaten the enemy, and we trust he will stay beaten. And we are prepared to knock his ugly head whenever and wherever else it shows itself. But as matters stood, I did have a slight change in my psychological condition. I started from home with a good idea of pity and sympathy for the Seventh-day Adventists. But before I had been there long, I began to transfer my pity to the other side. They were very badly off indeed. The more I saw of them, the more I felt inclined to blame you people for their condition. For you understand perfectly well what this spirit of persecution is and how it manifests itself. But it is a very hard thing for one to harry a man or persecute him and not have him give the other any reason for doing it. That always has been a very aggravating thing. It seemed to me that if you Seventh-day Adventists had been the good Christians you call yourselves and had acted as you should have done and had done to others as you would have been done by, you would not have kept behaving yourself so well in that aggravating way. It was hard on these people. There's no doubt about it. And I could not help saying to myself for them, if you have the real spirit of Christianity that you profess to have, why, oh, why don't you cut somebody's throat? There seemed to be a general feeling among the people there that you must either behave or go away. And if you refuse to do either, you see it was very hard on them. I was often encountered by persons there who said in a very querulous, complaining sort of way that those Adventists pay their debts better than anybody else around there. They seemed to feel hurt about it. The only man I saw there who did not belong to your people and who was seriously in favor of their release said that he wished that I would convert all of the fellows that owed him money to Seventh-day Adventism, because then he could collect his bills without suing. My friends, I feel inclined to talk to you in a very serious manner, for that is the mood in which I find myself the greater part of the time at present. For my own part, I believe that if the Seventh-day Adventist Church had never done anything else for Christianity or the world than to give birth to the International Religious Liberty Association and follow its principles, they would have done more for humanity than a Newton, a Kepler, or a Washington, or any of the greatest men that ever lived. I think this ought to entitle you to the gratitude of the nations as long as man shall live. I am not a prophet, nor the son of a prophet, and I do not pretend to know what will be the outcome of it all. But I know you have faith in your religion, and my faith in you is as strong as yours is in your religion. I believe that you have arisen in this country for a grand, glorious, and noble purpose. So far as I can see, the noble vessel in which you sail, and which you have rebuilt from the spars and timbers which have floated down to you from the wreck of the early church as it was founded, is destined to sail on to the heaven of glory and peace. I say, that grand ship which you have erected, I believe, will sail on to glorious victory. I know sometimes the sky looks black, and we see here and there around us the fast gathering clouds. In some quarters, the lightning is flashing, but we know that every man is at his post, every mast is firmly set and well guarded, that the sails are tightly fastened, and when above the roar of the tempest, the rush of the waters, and the whistling of the winds, a voice comes to us through the storm, "Are you not afraid that the vessel will sink?" We answer, "No, our master is at the helm." This is the end of Mr. Ringgold's speech.